Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Beijing. Bush is finding himself right now in the Middle East. He's flying around. I think he's in Singapore at the moment. He's on his way to Vietnam. Stopped off to say hi to good old Vladimir Putin. Remember Vlad? He's the guy who said, you want us to have democracy in Russia, and if democracy is what Iraq looks like, we'll pass. Yeah. And while Bush is not going to end up in China, it is Asia. And it is, I think, emblematic in some ways of this larger issue, of this whole larger issue of trade with Asia. And you know, as Nancy Pelosi refers to them as the butchers of Beijing. So I want to get into that a little later on in the program. It's probably in our second hour. This is a really important issue. What are we going to do about our trade policies, and where are we going to take them? But right now, Chris Slattery is with us. He's the founder and president of New York City's oldest and largest network of CPCs, Crisis Pregnancy Centers. ExpectantMotherCare.org is the website. Chris, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Chris, I have a report here. I'd like to just do a reality check with you on this. This came from Planned Parenthood in Indiana. They said that a 17-year-old girl mistakenly walked into one of your centers, not one of your centers, because you run them in New York, but a crisis pregnancy center in Indiana. It was next door to a real Planned Parenthood place. They took down the girl's confidential. I'm reading from the report. The group took down the girl's confidential personal information, told her to come back for her appointment, which they said would be in their other office, indicating the real Planned Parenthood office. When she showed up the next day for her non-existent appointment, she was met by the police, who had been erroneously tipped off that a minor was being forced to get an abortion. The crisis pregnancy center staff then followed up this harassment by staking out the girl's house, phoning her father at work, and even talking to her classmates about her pregnancy, urging them to harass her. Is this what you guys do?
That's a great scenario. It sounds like a novel. I find that hard to believe, to be honest with you. And I would never condone that kind of behavior anywhere, any organization in the pro-life movement.
Well, I think, you know, what's
passionately counseling 70,000 women over the last 21 years and have never had a scenario like that one. And we've saved 12 to 15,000 mothers who came in voluntarily and chose life who were considering abortion because they were given compassionate help, real alternatives. And because in New York State, there's no Right to Know Act. There's no obligation to inform women of the truth about what abortion can do to them. And when they hear about it in centers like ours in New York, they choose life.
Well, speaking about the right to know, House Resolution 5052, being put forward by Representative Maloney of New York, is a bill to stop deceptive advertising in women's services. In fact, that's the title of the bill. He notes, CPCs have intentionally placed advertisements in the abortion services sections of phone and internet directories. They choose names that are similar to nearby abortion clinics to confuse women about what types of services they provide. And once a woman calls to obtain information about their services, CPCs generally do not disclose that they do not provide abortion or birth control. In fact, many of them are starting to offer sonogram services as a way of trying to appear more like they may also offer abortion services.
Well, that's funny, Tom, because we've been offering sonogram services since 1985, almost 20 years. We did it because it's important that mothers see their baby in the womb before they abort it. And most of them that do get the chance to see the baby moving and squirming around in their tummy choose life. Now,
well, in fact, here's this came out of the Austin Life Care Center. A person went in thinking that she was going into an abortion clinic, got a sonogram. And when I asked her, she says, the person came out and said, here's a picture of your baby. Congratulations. And I mean, this is pretty strange stuff. It's somebody comes in looking.
What I think is strange is the hypocrisy of the, particularly the sponsors of that bill you just brought up, who in New York City completely covered for the fact that there were three abortion clinics in New York City that were simultaneously advertising under abortion providers and under the pro-life heading of abortion alternatives. And guess what? I just sued one of them and won in court.
But they also offer abortion alternatives.
No. The heading in this abortion alternative section says for advertisers who do not provide or perform abortions.
So would you agree to there just being an absolute segregation of those two?
Under alternatives, they're just trying a heading jump into the pro-life section.
Right, which they're saying that you guys have done. So would you agree to a segregation of the two?
The segregation of the two is fine. And we advertise exclusively under alternatives and have for over 20 years.
Okay.
The fact is that it's the abortion clinics that have been misleading and running deceptive advertising. Otherwise, why do you think the New York Civil Liberties Union, just in the last 2 weeks, settled with us out of court to stop? They signed a cease and desist order. This ACLU signed a cease and desist order, caved in immediately because they had no case.
Well, it's, you know,
we sued Dr.
Congratulations.
False advertising.
What can I say? Chris, we're talking with Chris Slattery. ExpectantMotherCare.org is the website. Chris, it sounds to me like you're really an advocate of forced pregnancy, that if a woman is pregnant, you believe that she should be forced to carry the baby full term.
Oh, that's forced pregnancy.
Well, because really isn't what we're really talking about here the definition of when life begins. You're asserting that life begins at conception. I would assert that life begins at viability, which is pretty much what the law says. And isn't that really what is dividing us?
Pro-life cause. Let's ban abortions after viability. I'm all for you. Let's start there.
But you would allow abortions before viability.
And Nancy Pelosi want to start with legislation that bans abortion after viability. That is a fantastic beginning.
That's the essence of Roe v. Wade. They kind of came up with this three-trimester thing.
You can't be serious. I mean, with the Doe versus Bolton companion case to Roe versus Wade, abortion is legal up until birth. Hello? It's openly advertised in the New York State Yellow Pages across the state up through 24 weeks. Babies are being delivered at 1 pound. Preemies are living at 18, 19 weeks, rarely, but occasionally. And then in the 20 to 24 weeks, many, many children can be saved. And
so then again, we have a problem about the
24 weeks.
Then again, we have a problem about the definition of viability.
Many of the abortions that are openly being performed across America by the tens of thousands per year.
So, great. Chris, do you think that abortion is murder?
Yes, I do.
So if somebody contracts to have somebody murdered, they are guilty of murder and they are subject to penalties for that. Do you think that women who contract to have abortions should be put to death by legal injection or by hanging or by firing squad?
Nice try, Tom.
Life in jail?
The only punishments I believe that should result in jail, fines, and the end of careers is for the physicians and those in the abortion facilities.
So then you don't think abortion is murder?
Tactics. Pardon?
Then you don't think that abortion is legally murder?
I do think it is.
But if it's legally murder, if you contract for murder, you yourself are a criminal.
Well, only if defined in the criminal code. And the pro-life movement is not in favor of criminalizing the behavior of the mother who's caught often in highly pressured situations, which we understand very much. Our counselors for 20-plus years have listened to thousands and thousands of stories and know the pain and suffering that women go through in a crisis pregnancy. Why they listen to us, and that's why two out of three choose life when given the proper assistance, which is what
the proper assistance. Here's an example of this. This is from the Cedar River Clinics. One person told me their horrifying experience going into a fake clinic. The name was Open Door, so they expected it to be supportive of women's decision regardless. What a nightmare. When the staff volunteer came out with the pregnancy test results, she literally ran over to us and yelled, "Congratulations, here's a gift for your new baby." Then they asked us what we wanted to do, and my daughter and I said we decided the best thing to do was to have an abortion, and what would that cost? The two ladies said, "Please wait a minute," left us. Then they came back with a doll and scissors and said, "This is what your baby looks like now, and we want you to start cutting her up because that's what will happen if you get an abortion. So start cutting her." I grabbed her and threw the doll at the ladies and got out of there fast. I later learned it wasn't a real clinic.
I can't. There's no way for me to verify whether this is just fiction or what, but obviously this is not the way to go. And the way to go is care, compassion, love.
Here's
giving women the truth, giving them free.
I agree with you on that, Chris. Mm-hmm. We only have a minute left. Also, Chris, if that, you and I are both men. Shouldn't men butt out of this debate? Shouldn't we just let women vote on this?
Let's have no male abortionists. So we'll probably wipe out about.
No, I'm saying let's say that males should not be able to vote on whether abortion is legal or not.
That's kind of silly, don't you think?
No, I have no idea what it's going to be like to be pregnant. I can't imagine it, and I don't think you could either.
99% of the time, men are involved in the pregnancy,
but they're not the ones who carry the baby.
True.
16. So Chris Slattery, his website, expectantmothercare.org. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hey, Mr. Politician, don't legislate, my love. You're not walking in my shoes. Don't hide behind your religion. It's my right to marry whom I choose. It's not your place to call me a sinner or decide who to have as my mate. Don't twist the words of the Bible to make laws that discriminate. Hey, Mr. Politician, there's no debate. We already separated church and state. Your religion should never abuse or take away my freedom.
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Why do I call it the radical middle? Well, because most of America is where we're at. If you ask most Americans, you know, do you support national health care? Do you support strong Social Security? Do you support strong labor unions, laws that will support strong labor unions? Do you support the breaking up of huge multinational corporations? Do you support trade policies that will actually protect American workers and keep jobs here in the United States? Do you support environmental protection? Do you support strengthening our public schools, even if we have to pay for it in our taxes? The vast majority of Americans will say yes in all those things. And the majority of Americans will say, do you support a woman's right to choose whether or not to have an abortion? And for that matter, do you support the right of men or women to choose to marry a person of the same sex? The majority of Americans now are saying yes. And not that those two are connected, but those are the, you know, not the 90%. They're more like the 55%. But still, here we are. So the question. And so I'd say that, you know, it boggles my mind when people who take the positions that I've just described, people like Nancy Pelosi, for example, take the positions that I've just described. They are referred to in the media as left-leaning, extreme left, or liberal, or ultra-liberal. And these are all the positions. If these are the positions that the majority of America wants, that the majority of America stands for, they're not liberal positions, they are American positions. Or maybe they, or you could say America is liberal. And they are liberal positions and American positions. And I'll go with that, you know, using Jack Kennedy's definition of a liberal. Certainly. Certainly. But it's not the left. I had on this program about a year ago, just to finally put a nail in the coffin of this debate, we had a guy on who is the president of the Communist Party of the United States of America, CPUSA. That's the left. On the Reich, on the far right, you've got, you know, the John Birch Society and the Republican Party right now. And, you know, we have them on from time to time. But the right is presented in our media. I mean, you've got Pat Buchanan all over the TV. The extreme right is presented in the media, but the extreme left, the Communist Party, the Socialist Workers' Party, they're never represented because they basically have no power. I mean, I had this guy from the Communist Party on, and he said, yeah, let's have the government nationalize everything. All industries should be owned by the government. I'm like, I don't think so. You know, I saw that in East Germany. I saw that in Russia. It didn't work. The left is dead in America, the old left. What we have is the vast American mainstream, which is what the media and people on the right refer to as the left, And then you've got the right-wing cranks. Anyhow, just to wrap up this thing with the abortion clinics, these clinics, these so-called emergency crisis or pregnancy crisis centers, they, CPCs, crisis pregnancy counseling centers. The state of Texas, for example, just budgeted $25 million, or just cut $25 million from their budget for planning, family planning. But they put aside $5 million to fund crisis pregnancy centers. As a result of that, just in the state of Texas, and this is happening all over the country, 17,000 low-income women will lose access to affordable family planning. The entire spectrum, from abortion all the way down to, well, you know, here's education about how birth control works as a result of these cuts. And that's just in Texas. According to Planned Parenthood, crisis pregnancy centers across the nation have received $60 million in government grants. The fellow we were just talking to, Chris Slattery, I don't know if he's getting any government grants or not, but that expectantmothercare.org, their website, they run the largest network of these things in New York. In the 1980s, crisis pregnancy centers would actually provide shelter to pregnant women right up until the eligible date for legal abortion had passed. Then they would turn the women out. This is according to Peggy Romberg at Planned Parenthood. These hardline tactics, she says, have softened after a number of states began cracking down. Texas's own attorney general sued to prevent crisis pregnancy centers from advertising themselves as abortion providers in 1985. Because they have so little overhead, crisis pregnancy centers are proliferating while clinics offering actual medical care lag behind. And NARAL Pro-Choice Texas noted that as of December 2005, there were only 43 abortion providers in Texas compared with 183 crisis pregnancy centers. I think we all can agree that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. But these guys, and I actually have had people representing the forced pregnancy movement on this program, and I've said, you know, okay, if a woman is a murderer, how should she be put to death if she has an abortion? And they've said, well, it should be up to the state, you know, whatever the technique the state uses. 27 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls. Welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, there's, in this whole abortion debate, you can go from the sublime to the absurd. Right? On the one hand, for example, for 28 years, I've done volunteer work with an international relief organization based in Germany. It's called Kinder und Jugendhilfswerk Salem. And the reason why I've ended up in all these weird war zones and, you know, in the Medellin Valley in Colombia and in Uganda during the war with Idi Amin and in Egypt when Sadat was shot and in Lima, Peru when the Shining Path blew up the presidential palace, and et cetera, and all that stuff that is in my bio that people say, oh, you must work for the CIA. No, it's, we build hospitals. But in any case, the founder of this organization, Gottfried Mueller, who's now 92 years old, and in many ways my mentor. I wrote a book about him called The Prophet's Way. He, at one point, this was maybe 25 years ago, he decided he was personally opposed to abortion. He thought that, you know, that abortion was, personally, for him, he felt that it was morally wrong. But he also felt that he had no right in inflicting his morality on others, and certainly the law made abortion legal. So how do you resolve this dilemma, particularly if, you know, and do something good in the world? So what he did, because he ran a chain of communities for abused and orphaned kids around Germany, what he did was he printed up some ads and some posters that said, if you're pregnant and you want to carry the baby to term, but you can't because of economic reasons, because there are some abortions that come about as a result of that, then we will provide you with housing and food and transportation throughout your pregnancy and for the first year thereafter, if you would like. We're here for you. No coercion, no funny stuff, no flim-flam, no we're going to pretend that we're going to do abortion and then you know, it's terrifying, nothing like that. So that's on the sublime side. That's the kind of reasonable side. On the unreasonable side, you got people like Neil Horsley, this is great. Neil Horsley was being interviewed by Alan Colmes about, I don't know, 6 months ago or so on the Alan Colmes show, Alan Colmes of Fox News. And this clip kind of got out into the blogosphere, and we put a little bit of Mr. Ed into it. You'll hear why in just a second. Here's Neil Horsley being interviewed by Alan Colmes.
You are known for your anti-abortion and anti-homosexual views.
Now, let me just insert, by the way. In fact, let me start this over again. Neil Horsley is the guy who runs the website where they put up pictures of abortion doctors and put a big red X through them when they are murdered. That's what this guy does, okay? Neil Horsley. He's like one of the leading anti-abortion guys in the country.
You are known for your anti-abortion and anti-homosexual views. You had sex with animals?
Oh, when you grow up on a farm in Georgia, your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that's so.
You didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia. Did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
I'm saying that it has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from the
reality. Look, I'll admit, Neil, I'm a city boy. I don't know a lot about growing up on a farm.
Well, welcome to domestic life on the farm.
But I think for you to say, there are a lot of people listening to you right, Neil, there are a lot of people listening to me right now who live on farms, are raising kids on farms, who grew up on farms, and I don't think they're dating Elsie right now. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, don't know that in fact you experiment with anything that moves when you're growing up sexually, you're naive, and you know better than that. You know yourself. If it's warm and if it's damp and it vibrates, you might in fact have sex with it.
No, not me.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes,
no,
you
thanks.
Oh, come on, you know. I've had sex with anything that would move.
Right.
If we had a warm watermelon out in the field, I might give it a name.
Hello, I'm Mr. Ed.
Yeah, so our little packaged discussion between Alan Colmes and Neil Horsley. Neil Horsley, one of the leaders of the anti-abortion movement in the United States at the time of that interview. I don't think he is anymore, but at the time of that interview. So, I mean, there's a serious side to this. There's a really serious side to this, and a lot of this has to do with the control of women. And that's why I suggested that men really should not have any say in this issue, frankly. I mean, Louise and I have three children. Louise has been pregnant four times. She had a miscarriage. And I delivered two out of those three children, one at home and one in a birthing center. Well, actually, Louise would say she delivered them. I caught them. And obviously, I was involved in the pregnancies. And I still can't imagine. I can't imagine what it would be like to have something growing inside me. I just, you know, I can't imagine it. The plus side or the negative side. I mean, something that could kill you as well. Because the risk of an abortion medically is less than the risk of having a pregnancy, a full-term pregnancy. More women die from pregnancy than from abortion. I mean, it's just a simple statistic. I just can't imagine it. And so I don't think that I should be the one who has a say in it. And the other thing is this whole issue of men making decisions for women. I mean, here we have, you know, millennia of patriarchy. Anyway, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Ken in Sacramento, California. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind today?
Well, I have two questions for you, Tom, and I'll take the answers off the air, but here they are. Why is the left not giving the environmental argument and the economic argument for women's rights? And the environmental argument being, overpopulation, fresh water and food allocation, and raw material allocation. When you begin to have such high societal population pressures, what kind of future are we giving these children anyways?
Right. Well, if you apply those arguments to birth control, they make a lot of sense. If you apply them to abortion, then the other side starts screaming euthanasia, and that's why nobody's willing to go there.
Well, what about the argument for creating an economic environment in which these women that are having these children can actually afford to have them? As far as I can tell, if you create an environment where you have universal health care, guaranteed, well, not guaranteed employment, but at least, you know, a fair wage coming in, isn't there more of an inclination to keep the children?
Well, and yes, absolutely. And in fact, oddly enough, the conservatives are totally opposed to that. Now, I can't speak for the abortion, the forced pregnancy movement, but they call themselves the pro-life movement, although many of them are in favor of the death penalty and wars in Iraq and things like that. So let's talk about what it is. It's forced pregnancy. I can't speak for them, but,
and just one last thing. I think from your position, if you really start arguing again, we're men. We really don't have a say in this. I think that is absolutely correct, and it should be hammered. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Ken. Good talking to you. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey. Hey, Paula.
Hi, Tom. There are just a few points about your guest. One, he implied that abortion clinics pressure women to have abortions, yet provided no examples. Two.
Right, and in fact, that the record shows very clearly that clinics that offer abortion services and other prenatal services are not selling abortion. They're not pushing abortion. Nobody is enthusiastic about abortion. I don't know anybody who is. I've never met anybody who is.
Two, you didn't ask him. He, you know, talked about the compassionate care that they give women with crisis pregnancies. How long does that last? Do they go through the pregnancy with it? Do they check up? Or does it end at the decision, you know, to carry the pregnancy to term? I mean, do they call up the mother, make sure she has daycare?
Well, what they were doing in Texas until the attorney general stopped them in 1985 was they were offering them shelter, a place to live and food and services and money until they had reached the point, I think it was the end of the second trimester, the 6 months, after that abortion was illegal in Texas. And so the day after the woman could no longer legally get an abortion, then they said, okay, you're on your own.
And my third point is, why aren't they fighting to guarantee high-quality, government-funded prenatal care for every woman who conceives a child?
Because this is about the ideology, Paul. Yeah, I mean, you're asking the rational questions, and I find it a little uncomfortable trying to take their position because I don't, you know, I'm not in their place. But that, yeah, good point.
And I just want to make like a personal point. I'm 37 years old. My husband and I made a decision not to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
We take every precaution that medical science has given to us to prevent that from happening. But if it happens, should I be forced at 37 to have a baby I don't want?
Well, according to our guest, yes. And in my mind, no. And I think it should be your decision. It should be between you, your doctor, and, you know, whatever
ethical or religious system. How many people would be willing to adopt the child of a 37-year-old woman?
Well, or just adopt a child in general. I mean, I can tell you, having worked in the child welfare system broadly, that there are tens of thousands of children in the United States right now looking for adoptive homes and not finding them. And if these guys put half as much effort into, and thank you, Paula, for the call, if they put half as much effort into finding homes for those children who are born and who actually need a home, or the children living in poverty. I mean, here, this report that came out today, I want to get into this as well, and we'll get back to your calls right after the break, but this report that 35 million people in the United States are living in food insecurity. They literally don't know where their next meal is going to come from. 35 million born people. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Strangers on the right, invading Congress. Strangers on the right, impeding progress. They'll put up a fight. To liberals like you, something in their eyes resembles fire. Roe v. Wade's demise is their desire. Cutting down to size those states that still are blue.
And welcome back. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour, strangers on the right, I'll tell you. Welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman program. At the same time that $60 million in federal money is going to these so-called crisis pregnancy centers, these anti-abortion counseling centers, shall we say, the Agriculture Department released a survey today. Last year, and two interesting things about this survey. First are the statistics in it, and the second is the use of the words. In the report, the terms low food security and very low food security are used to replace the old descriptions. See, prior to the Bush administration, prior to this year, actually, we used to refer to food insecurity without hunger. In other words, people don't know where their next meal is coming from, but they do have access to resources where they can find food, like a shelter down the street kind of thing. And food insecurity with hunger. In other words, literally, people are going to go to bed hungry that night. Period. No disagreement on it. There are 10.8 million people in the United States who have what is referred to now as very low food insecurity, or very low food security. What used to be referred to as food insecurity with hunger. And an additional 24 million people with low food security, what used to be referred to as food insecurity without hunger. And we're going to put all kinds of money and resources into making abortion illegal. Sean in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. Hey, this isn't why I called, but I wanted to tell you, didn't you hear that Neil Horsley is now a Democrat?
You're kidding.
No, because, you know, you found out that mules are more sexually promiscuous than elephants. I always come in with a really good Neil Horsley joke. It's really strange that you brought him up.
You do,
anyway,
Sean.
Anyway, that's my third in a row, by the way. For any of you...
For those people who have been listening for more than a year.
Oh, I've been listening to you for about six, actually.
Yeah, we've been on the air for a little over 3.5 years, so it's been that. You've been right from the very beginning, Sean.
Well,
I appreciate it.
It was when you were with...
With IE America Radio, yeah. It was going 4 years ago, yeah. Me and Mike Malloy and the bunch, yeah.
Hey, I don't know why anybody doesn't bring this up to wackos like Chris. What about all the post-birth abortions that we've killed in Iraq over the last 3 years?
Mm.
The people that have already been born.
Yeah, good point. And not just that. I mean, if you've got 10.8 million people who have very low food security, that is to say food insecurity with hunger, that you are in the process, you are doing slow whatever. I mean, I don't even want to call it an abortion, but it's just, you're absolutely right, Sean, and well said. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Is it Ian in San Francisco?
Hi, Tom.
Hi,
yeah.
Ian.
I wanted to follow up a little bit on this prenatal care.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I think these people should be asked is, and this would really put them on the spot, I think, they say they care about the fetus, they say they're pro-life. Well, would they ever agree to government financing of prenatal care for undocumented aliens?
I suspect that they would in a heartbeat, since they end up with the money, and because they, I think that their ideology transcends national borders. In a heartbeat, they would say that they want the money to talk women out of having an abortion, even if they're not citizens of the United States.
Well,
I'm sure that they would.
What I'm getting at, though, is that generally in the Congress, if you look at the conservatives who support the so-called pro-life movement, they vote against expanding government finance prenatal care.
Right across the board, whether it's for illegal aliens or for American citizens.
One other thought is when you talk to these guys in the future and they call it murder, you might mention that in most places murder has no statute of limitations. So that means that all the people... the relatives that you know in your family, anybody who's had an abortion in the past in a state that has a murder law, and they all do, is guilty and could be charged now. It's not like it's just in the future.
Well, as I said, I've had these guys on this program, and I've asked them that question, and he says, nice try. But I've had other ones say, well, you know, it's murder. It should be however the state executes people. That's how they should do it. Ian, got to run along. Thanks a lot for the call, though. I appreciate it. Charles in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Charles.
What's going on?
Hey, I'm here. What's up?
I just want to say, if we had some type of real adoption, in this nation. That might help alleviate a lot of what's going on with our abortion problems.
I agree. Our abortion, the number of abortions that we have in the United States could be dramatically reduced, and not to say that it's super high to begin with, but it could be dramatically reduced by improving the economy. So that people who would like to have children feel safe to do so, number one, and number two, by having a national health care system. Frankly, I think that would have some impact on it. And number three, by improving adoption services. You're absolutely right. It's real. This is not rocket science. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in El Cerrito, California. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I first of all, that guest, did you say 60 million is being spent on of taxpayer money being
yeah,
spent?
Yeah, nationwide.
Yeah.
Supporting these kind of programs.
And of course, that's completely obscene. And I found the guest's sort of position about criminalizing, what we should do with women who have abortions. I found it totally inconsistent. But I'm a registered libertarian. I voted for Democrats down the line this year, and I really am not as interested in the economic benefits of having a Democrat's office. I want civil liberties to be really the number one watchword again.
Yeah,
I don't
I
know
agree.
If that's realistic, but
Jeff, I agree, because we're watching 230 years of democracy that Americans have fought and died for, have bled over, have invested our wealth and our energy and our lives in, being drained down the pick your metaphor. By this administration with the Military Commissions Act and things like this. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, it's the Tom Hartman radio program, 6 minutes past the hour. Lloyd Chapman is with us. He's with the American Small Business League, ASBL.com, their website. Lloyd, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be on your show.
Great to have you with us. You guys have documented how over $100 billion, let me set this up, actually, in October, the October figures just came out from the Department of the Treasury and the IRS and the whole shooting match. In October, you and I, people, individuals in the United States, paid $86 billion in taxes during that month. In October, corporations paid $9 billion in taxes toward the cost of administering our government, our war in Iraq, defending business interests all around the world, maintaining our court systems, providing an educated workforce to business, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Number one, that seems to me wildly out of balance. And secondly, that $86 billion that we paid, a good chunk of that is now going to some of the largest multinational corporations on earth, in the form of Small Business Administration grants that are supposed to go to small companies like, the one that I own, it's this radio show, or, I don't know if ASBL is a corporation or a nonprofit, but, I mean, small businesses, what's going on here?
Well, it's actually incredible. There's a federal law that's been on the books since 1953 that says 23% of the total value of all government contracts and subcontracts should go to small businesses. And I uncovered in 2002 that most of that money actually goes to some of the biggest companies in the world, both in the U.S. and in Europe. And the Bush administration is trying to cover it up, frantically, ever since I got the first stories in the press on this in 2002. And in fact, it just got worse yesterday. The government issued a new policy that came out yesterday that's going to give large corporations 5 more years of small business contracts, and I project that over the next 5 years, it's going to divert somewhere between $300 and $500 billion in funds that Congress set aside for small businesses to Fortune 500 corporations. That's just unbelievable.
That's incredible. When you consider that, $300 billion is enough to buy a full 4-year scholarship for some 14 million people to go to public universities. I mean, this is mind-boggling. Lloyd, let's just for the benefit of our listeners, the importance of small business. Why would Congress in 1953 say that 23% of federal contracts have to go to small businesses?
That's a great question, Tom. The U.S. Census Bureau tells us that 98% of all American companies have less than 100 employees. And that's where around 60% of the population are employed, and that's where the vast majority of the tax revenue comes from. It's where the vast majority of the new jobs are created. I think 98% of new jobs come from those companies, most of the exports and most of the innovation. So it makes sense to do business with the companies where most Americans work, where most of the tax revenue comes from, America's middle class. And I view America's middle class and these small businesses with less than 100 employees, that's the heart and soul of the U.S. economy. And the Bush administration has established these policies that have diverted billions of dollars from the middle class to large defense contractors that just happen to be, this is going to surprise you, some of the biggest contributors to the Republican National Committee.
Yeah, you know, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Verizon, and Microsoft are getting Small Business Administration grants?
That's right, along with probably 500 other companies. The list is just staggering.
How? How do you do this? I mean, the Small Business Administration has the word small business in their title. You would think that the people working there would know what they're supposed to do.
Well, I'll tell you something. It's the SBA. It's also the Office of Management and Budget and the General Service Administration. Those three agencies work, you know, hand in glove to do this. Mm-hmm. And these funds have been diverted through policies that have been developed by the SBA, the Office of Management and Budget, and the GSA to achieve the specific goal. And they're not letting up. There have been 13 federal investigations, Tom, that have showed that billions of dollars in funds earmarked for small business have been diverted to Fortune 500 corporations. Three investigations found outright fraud, and yet no one's been prosecuted. Nothing's been done. The Republican administration just keeps making more and more policies to divert more and more small business contracts to big companies.
Lloyd Chapman, president of the American Small Business League. First of all, was it different under the Clinton administration?
You know, I'll have to say that it wasn't this bad. I'll have to say it actually started in the Reagan administration. I didn't know this. I'm actually originally Republican from Round Rock, Texas.
I guess I shouldn't have asked that question.
That's okay. And I was very disenchanted when
Andrew?
I found out that Ronald Reagan actually tried to...
I cannot
to
hear him. I'm sorry.
He tried to
I can only hear him when you hit the button. Somebody's grabbed your mix minus. We're talking with Lloyd Chapman. He is the president of the American Small Business League, and apparently he's still with us and on the air, but I can't hear him. We've got a problem with the board at Air America in New York.
Tom, can you hear me?
What I'm going to do, since I can't hear Lloyd, is I'm going to thank Lloyd for being with us. Thank you very much, Lloyd, and we appreciate you being on the program. The website, asbl.com, if you want to go check it out. And you can get all kinds of information there. And I want to get back to this, to the issue that I brought up at the very beginning of the first hour. Apprehensions run high in Beijing and Washington. This is from today's Wall Street Journal, an article by Neil King, Jr. Apprehensions run high in Beijing and Washington that a Pelosi-led, Democrat-controlled House could seize on China trade and security issues to bash President Bush, much as congressional Republicans did in the final years of the Clinton administration. You know, here's some quotes from Nancy Pelosi, just to lay this stuff out. On January 24th, 1990, she says, Congress must send a very clear signal to the butchers of Beijing. The butchers of Beijing. Nancy Pelosi. On October 29th, 1997, she said, it is not right to roll out the red carpet for the leader of the country that rolled out the tanks at Tiananmen Square. God bless her. October 29th, 1997. That was a decade after Tiananmen Square. The China policy, here, May 19th, 2005. The China policy of the United States, Democrats and Republicans alike, is a total failure. Yes, it is. And again, what Lloyd Chapman was talking about, the American Small Business League, this whole concept of of handing everything over to big multinational corporations, handing with NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization, what we have done is we have handed our trade policy, our sovereignty as a nation, over to giant multinational corporations and said, okay, you guys handle it. You do it. And what do? They run our trade policy in a way that causes multinational corporations to get richer and richer and us to get screwed. Here's Nancy Pelosi again. April 20th, 2006. Bush administration officials say they hope that China will become a responsible stakeholder. We should avoid wishful thinking. So here, China's ambassador to Washington, Zhao Wenchang, expressed concern that the new Congress could be, quote, more concerned about trade and about human rights issues, end quote. Gee, the ambassador from China is worried that Congress might suddenly be concerned about trade and human rights issues, like keeping jobs in America and not doing business with countries that torture and kill their own people and put people in prison for simply speaking out politically or even joining a religion, Falun Gong. They're concerned that we might be concerned about that instead of the old Republican concern of, hey, is it going to be good for Walmart? You know, 40% of international trade, roughly 40% of all international trade, is intra-company trade. It is one company trading with itself from one country to another. Of course these giant multinational corporations, of course they want to do away with tariffs. They want to do away with restrictions to trade. Because if they make something overseas, they want to be able to sell it to themselves, that is, bring it into this country, and not have to pay any kind of a tariff on it. So basically, they can outsource our labor. I mean, if General Motors wants to close down 7 factories in Michigan and open 7 factories in Mexico, which is what they did back in the 1980s, as Reagan made all this very, very viable. Michael Moore documented it so well in his book about Roger Smith, the president of GM. If they want to do that, They should have to pay, in my opinion, they should have to pay a tariff to balance it. But anyhow, the Chinese are concerned that Nancy Pelosi might be more concerned about trade and human rights issues. Administration officials, this is from the Wall Street Journal again, administration officials say that in private conversations, Chinese diplomats have expressed deeper worries about the new Congress than their ambassador has in public remarks. Oh, geez, we might start holding the multinational corporations and their benefactors in China responsible for some of their policies and some of their activities? I think it would be a great thing, an absolutely great thing. 16 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, The True People's Radio.
Who's on the hill and who's watching the valley? Who's in charge of it all? God bless the army and God bless our liberty. Let come the rest of it all. Then a minute position of back and away. Freedom's stuck in reverse. Let's get out of Iraq, get back on the track, and let's rebuild America first.
Yes, indeed, let's rebuild America first. Merle Haggard. Man, let's get out of Iraq and get back on the track. When you've lost Merle Haggard, you've lost America. That's the guy who did the Okie from Muskogee song back in the old days, back when I was a DJ. And I'll tell you, back before I started doing news, I was a music guy for 3 years and then did news for 7 years and then got out of the business in 1978 and came back on about 4 years ago to do progressive talk radio. Merle Haggard, what is an icon, I mean, in country music. And here he is. The video, in fact, is incredible. You can find it over on YouTube of that. By the way, I'll be at the Live Wire at the Aladdin Theater in Portland tonight about my new book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. It's a radio variety show. So for those folks in the Pacific Northwest interested in that. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here. Welcome back from with the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Glenn Beck, notorious right-wing crank, formerly on the radio, now on C-SPAN. Fine opportunity and good reason to flip the channel over to MSNBC every day. Yesterday, talking to the first Muslim member of Congress. The first Muslim member of Congress. This is Keith Ellison is his name. He's a Democrat from Minnesota. And Glenn Beck.
I have to tell you, I have been nervous about this interview with you because what I feel like saying is, sir, prove to me that you are not working with our enemies. And I know you're not. I'm not accusing you of being an enemy, but that's the way I feel, and I think a lot of Americans will feel that way.
Oh, man. Isn't that obscene? I mean, that's like my getting Glenn Beck on and saying, sir, prove to me that that you didn't murder 16 people last week. Prove it. Well, and that you don't intend to kill me. Well, I mean, prove a negative?
Well, let me tell you, the people of the 5th Congressional District know that I have a deep love and affection for my country. There's no one who is more patriotic than I am. And so, you know, I don't need to prove my patriotic stripes.
And I'm not asking you to. I'm wondering if you see that. You come from a district that is heavily immigrant with Somalians, and I think it's wonderful. Honestly, I think it is really a good sign that you could be an icon to show Europe. This is the way you integrate into a country. I think the Somalians coming out and voting is a very good thing. With that being...
I agree with you.
Yeah. Okay, that... Nice save, Glenn, but sorry. It's proved to me. I don't get it. 1-866-440-8466. Russell in Queen Valley, Arizona. Hey, Russell, what's up?
Oh.
Hey, Russell.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I wanted to bring up two points that I think are very, very important that we need to deal with as a nation and for the whole world. Abortion is one. And
apropos of our last hour. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's what I listed. We're like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
what's
that's
the topic?
Fine. No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Oh, I
was. That was for our listeners who may have just tuned in. We were discussing abortion in the first hour of the program. What's your thoughts on it?
Well, basically, it won't be long that our numbers will be reduced by nature if we don't do it. And to me,
it's already happening. I mean, you have 6 billion people in the world, and 1 billion of those 6 billion people right now have tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is the fastest growing disease in the world. We have multi-drug resistant TB spreading all over the world. I remember when the last time I was in India, I was in the Hyderabad airport and reading the Indian Business Journal. And it talked about how there's 300 million people in India with tuberculosis.
I know.
And I'm reading this, and there's this guy standing about 20 feet away from me, hacking his lungs out into a wastebasket, and everybody around him has just moved away. He's got this big, total, you know, 20-foot radius around him. Nobody will go near him.
Oh, God.
And it's like... And it's not just India now. It's the multi-drug resistant TB outbreaks are happening in the United States in our major cities. This is just a small indication. AIDS, HIV. I mean, and rather than you get all these right wing cranks out here saying, oh well, we've got to have more babies. We're going into negative population growth. It's terrible. I'm sorry, we have 6 billion people. There were 3 billion people the day Jack Kennedy was inaugurated president. The world was not overpopulated, not underpopulated at that time.
Well, you know, about a couple months ago, I finished reading a book called Collapse, and it talked about different societies that survived and adapted, for instance, the Australian Aborigines and other ones that collapsed. And one of the common denominators for the ones that survived were that the wealthy had to see their best interests were tied up with the poor people in their society. And with all our corporations moving offshore, they don't believe that their welfare is tied up with ours, even though it is.
Absolutely right. In fact, Russell, that is absolutely one of the most important points that can be made because what we have, and thank you for the call, increasingly what we have are big corporations who are making decisions on a local basis, and the person making those decisions does not have to look into the faces of the people that they're laying off or that they're firing or whose lives they're destroying or whose community they're polluting. And they're living back, in some other city in their gated communities and going, it's just for the bottom line. 27 minutes past the hour.
Patriot Act at home. It's modern 10 you and me. spot six.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Or reality shows cross the line. Jessica Simpson's made
mass destruction.
Yes, I'm so sick and tired of all this bullshit on TV.
It's the bullshit.
Entertainment ain't as entertaining as entertainment can be.
And welcome back to the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no RNC pass required. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 35 minutes past the hour. After Beijing crushed the democracy protests in Tiananmen Square in 1989, Mrs. Pelosi battled the first Bush administration and helped to protect Chinese students in the U.S. This is from Neil King's piece in today's Wall Street Journal. She also worked to make dents in the U.S. Excuse me. She also worked to make preferential trade benefits to congressional to China, conditional on its showing significant progress on human rights. Time to clean my glasses here. In September 1991, Chinese police stopped Mrs. Pelosi and two other U.S. lawmakers on Tiananmen Square after they unfurled a pro-democracy banner. The Chinese Foreign Ministry called the move a premeditated anti-Chinese farce. This now the most powerful woman in the world, Nancy Pelosi, today elected as Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States of America. In March, as the White House prepared to welcome Chinese President Hu Jintao, Mrs. Pelosi, Mr. Rangel, and 14 other Democrats wrote to Mr. Bush urging the U.S. to file more cases against China and other countries within the WTO. In an opinion piece published in the L.A. Times the day after Mr. Hu arrived, Ms. Pelosi wrote, quote, "The American people want the administration to show resolve in standing up to Beijing to demonstrate that we believe that the Chinese people deserve freedom." End quote. I would suggest that the American people, not only the Chinese people deserve freedom, the American people deserve economic freedom. And that means no more multinational corporations being able to use China as their factory floor for products that they intend to sell in the United States. It's just real simple. Call me a protectionist. I will proudly raise my hand. Yes, I believe in protecting American jobs and protecting the United States. I am a protectionist. Why? What about free trade? Thomas Friedman tells us it's a wonderful thing. The world is flat. Thomas Friedman, the billionaire Thomas Friedman, is full of beans. I'm sorry. Free trade is free to multinational corporations. It's free to nobody else. Steny Hoyer, by the way, has a pretty good voting record on this stuff. He's 100% by NARAL, our first hour. Steny Hoyer, the new majority leader in the House of Representatives. On the budget and economy, he voted for the bankruptcy bill. Yeah. Oh, well. He's rated 87% by the ACLU on a pro-civil rights voting record. He voted no on a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, no on protecting the Pledge of Allegiance, no on a constitutional amendment prohibiting flag desecration, no on banning gay adoptions, no on ending preferential treatment by race in college admissions. His only yes, the uncomfortable vote here, was on the Patriot Act, making it permanent. He's only rated 40% by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They don't like him. That's good by me. He voted to require DNA testing for all federal executions. In other words, make sure somebody actually committed a crime if you're going to do that. He voted yes on funding for alternative sentencing instead of more prisons. He's got a pretty reasonable. He's voted 100% by the National Education Association, voting consistently with teachers in the United States. Good on him. He voted yes on the Kyoto Protocol. The guy's fairly progressive. 22% by the Cato Institute, so they don't like him. They say that he's pro-fair trade instead of pro-free trade. He voted no on implementing CAFTA. He did vote yes on a few of these things. He voted no on fast track for trade agreements. That was back in 98. So anyhow, I've got issues2002.org. That's, you know, as of, I don't know if it's current or not, but it's a really good history of Steny Hoyer. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 440-8466. And Bob in Seattle, Washington on the line. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, you know, this voodoo trade deficit that we're, the trade policy that we're following?
Yeah.
well, it's what, approaching $800 billion. I keep hearing this conservative misinformation that every time they lower tax rates, revenues increase. And, of course, Bush has been out here saying that, you know, the projection that they had for the deficit this year was lower than their projection because of increased revenues. The implication was that it was because of increased revenues from personal federal income taxes. But my understanding is that Congress passed a law, this current Republican-controlled Congress, that for the multinational corporations that had all this excess cash because of all of the stuff made in China, but when they bring the money back into our economy, they'd have to pay 35%, just like a domestic corporation would have to pay if
they produced. Income tax on it. Yeah, but, and what they did was they cut that down to 5% for 1 year.
5.5%. Well, I thought it was 5 or 5.5.
May well have been 5.5.
Yeah,
in that neighborhood. Yeah.
But because of the immense amount of money. And by the way, they paid no self-employment, so they're in a 5.5% tax bracket.
Right.
I mean, give me, so there's your 9% of the corporate share of.
Oh yeah, yeah. There has been a balloon in federal deficit, in federal receipts this year, in large part as a result of the Bush administration giving this huge tax break to multinational corporations so that they can bring profits home. Number one, but number two, and probably more important, Bob, is that. Economies, particularly an economy as massive as the United States, is at a certain level a self-healing organism. It's an adaptive organism. It's almost like a living thing in some ways. And so if you, as Roosevelt did, raise the top income tax rate up to 90% and put a stiff corporate tax rate, I believe that Roosevelt's was 50 or 60%, the top income tax rate on corporations into place, then the economy will adapt to that, and people will figure out not how to get around the tax laws, but the economy as a whole and corporations and individuals within it will figure out how to work within that framework. It may take a year or two, but they eventually adapt to it. And similarly, if you drop the top tax rate, as Kennedy did, well, actually it happened after Kennedy was assassinated, but he had proposed it, from 90% down to 70%, you know, there will be an adaptation. Now, that was actually a tax increase at a certain level because Kennedy closed, or at least that's what Kennedy proposed in the first place, was to close a whole bunch of loopholes. But there was an actual drop in revenues in the first year, and then it slowly kicked back up again. In other words, the economy just kind of recovered from it. Reagan drops it down to 27%. The economy revenues drop massively, and then over a few year period, it starts coming back up again. Bush does his craziness three or four years ago, throws us into a deficit, but the economy slowly recovers and the tax receipts come back. I would argue that all of this indicates that tax receipts, well, not just tax receipts, that the economy as a whole pretty much operates independent of tax policy. The tax policy is not the major driver of the economy. And all the more reason to go back to the kind of income taxes, personal and corporate, that we had under Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower, and that built the strongest middle class in the history of the world, than you know, maintain what we have right now. But Bush is claiming credit for this, yes.
He's claiming credit. By the way, Tom, not to switch subjects, but if you could play the, if you could get the recording of Amy Goodman confronting Chris Matthews for the firing of Phil Donahue and hearing Matthews babble, which I saw on MSNBC, they'll probably never have her back as a guest.
You bet on it. Yeah, it's unfortunate because she's one of the most articulate voices, progressive voices in America. And they will never have an articulate progressive on the talking head shows. They're always looking for people who are stumbling and falling all over themselves and can't quite put together a sentence. And
well, Fox has a straw man, ex-Democratic pollster every time there's an election.
Yeah.
I forget his name. He has a beard. He kind of looks like a left winger, but he always says that Democrats are going to lose.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It really is. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. It's tragic. Brian in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Long time. I figured I'd call you because I thought you might have an answer. I just watched that America, Freedom, the Fascism by Aaron Rousseau. I'm sure you've heard of it.
Yeah, I've seen the trailer. I interviewed Aaron Rousseau on my morning program. I haven't watched the movie yet.
You can actually watch it on Google Video.
No, I have the CD. I just haven't had the time.
Okay, I mean, I don't know if what he's saying there is true. It seems pretty well backed up. Is it true that that we don't have to pay an income tax because of some
No.
Now it's not true?
No, it's not. And Wikipedia, actually, probably has the best piece on this. You'd have to go over to Wikipedia and type in something about income tax, and you'll find, just type in income tax, and you'll find the link to the you don't have to pay an income tax. It's all based on the assertion that the, what was it, 16th Amendment, whatever the amendment was, that
16th,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, that created, that, you know, that allowed for an income tax, wasn't ratified by one last state, and that the Fed isn't, you know, legitimate and all this stuff. And, you know, you can build some of those arguments, just like I can build an argument that the Supreme Court didn't claim that corporations are persons in 1886. I mean,
right.
There's a technical truth there. But the reality, the practical reality, is that these things have been certified and ratified and repeatedly so often by
right.
the Supreme Court and other other institutions that it's a fantasy. And it's a shame that Aaron Rousseau mixed up the anti-tax movement with fascism. It's just a shame. 45 minutes past the hour.
Factories where sulfur coal was burned. The atmosphere cried dirty tears, but no one was concerned. Exploding populations turning wetlands into malls. People drove their Hummers without any kilt at all. Who will be the one? Who will be the one? Who feels that precious liquid rolling down their thirsty tongue? Who will be the one? What will it be worth? The one who drinks the final drop of water on the earth.
And welcome back. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. You know, it's amazing, Tom, that all of the news media is playing up this big fight between Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and Murtha. And when, of course, Hoyer won by, you know, 2-1.
Yeah.
And as I think I said to you the other day, it was very clear that Nancy Pelosi had to look like she was supporting Murtha. You know, she checked it off. She always knew that Steny Hoyer was going to win, and it wasn't even a question.
Yeah, this was basically what happened was back when Nancy Pelosi wanted to be the leader of the House, of the Democrats in the House, the minority leader, she Jack Murtha came in and managed her campaign. He put her in that position where when they came into the majority, she would be the Speaker of the House, and she had to thank him, basically.
Exactly. And everybody knew what the outcome was. And they're making this like all the press articles I've been looking on the Internet, the AP, you know, this is a long-standing feud. And, oh, please. I mean,
yeah.
There's no feud at all. Nancy Pelosi and Hoyer get along extremely well.
Yeah, no, they're in fact, all three of these guys are of these
of
people
course.
Are friends.
It's just
I'm curious, Ellen, if some of the dirt on Steny Hoyer and Jack Murtha in particular that has been released to the press over the last few days was released by the Republicans, because on the Democratic side, both camps are saying we didn't put that out.
My guess is that it was released and, you know, was released in a whisper campaign or released in a way that looks like it came from the Democrats. And speaking of the Democrats, your favorite friend has reared his head and is claiming victory.
Uh-oh.
Mr. Fromm from the DLC.
Oh, David Fromm. Oh, jeez. The DLC. Well, the New York Times today. I mean, this article about how Howard Dean, you know, who won, Dean or Rahm Emanuel? And did Dean support Emanuel? It was Rahm Emanuel who was cutting off funds to progressive Democratic candidates like your friend Ellen Simon in Arizona. And it was Howard Dean who was launching a 50-state strategy. And now you've got, here on CNN yesterday, James Carville coming out and just, you know, reaming Dean, you know, raging at him. Carville, I'm assuming, is part of the DLC.
Well, he certainly is part of the Hillary Clinton crowd, who, as you know, the Clintons, when Al Fromm had his 50th birthday, gave him a huge White House 50th birthday party.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're, you know, they're very, very close. Yeah. Let's put it that way. A couple other presidential people entering. Senator Evan Bayh, no surprise, said that he is going to wait till early next year about whether he's going to involve himself in a White House race.
There's
but
another DLC Democrat for you.
Yeah, he's got $10 million. And that is about minimum of what he needs to enter. And guess who else is entering, which I'm kind of surprised about? Secretary, former HHS from the Republican side, Secretary Tommy Thompson.
That's
and he, believe it or not, will come out with a very moderate Republican view.
Yeah.
I know the guy, and he is not exactly a friend of the right wing.
No, he's sort of the Nelson Rockefeller of the Republican Party in some ways.
Exactly.
Interesting, interesting.
Exactly. Very concerned about health care issues. Definitely not a right-winger. It'll be interesting to see what happens. And my guess is that he had not even really thought about it until he saw the election results and feels like he can capitalize on the middle. I know him pretty well.
Yeah. Alan, in today's Wall Street Journal, big article about how the Chinese and multinational corporations are very worried about Nancy Pelosi and the democratically
led...
Well,
she says she's going after them.
Right. What do you think is... How do you think this is going to play out? What's your sense of this? How much of this is bluster and how much of it actually might be translated into policy?
It really depends whether she has any teeth and who she sort of, you know, gets and how much she's behind... whoever essentially is our intelligence committee, foreign relations, that kind of thing. Because without the committee structure, she can bluster all she wants, and that's all it is. It depends how much the committee people are going to make the agenda that way in terms of oversight.
And the committees, by and large, exist outside of her sphere of influence. I mean, she has the ability to appoint committee members, but basically it's a seniority system.
It also has to do, that's right, but it also has to do with the State Department budget and what they're going to be doing with that. And, I mean, one is free trade issues. The other is when they do oversight on the State Department bill, what that's going
to
mean.
Yeah, I mean, there is really, with regard to China, there's three issues here. One is whether you're going to have corporate free trade, allowing corporations to set up factories there and import stuff into the United States without paying a tariff. The second is human rights, whether we're going to continue to you know, have our corporations set up factories in a country that kills its own citizens, in fact kills them to sell their body parts, and three, workers' rights, you know, whether in any of these trade agreements they're going to put in worker and environmental protections. These are three different committees?
Well, some of the bills, you know, by the new committee structure, because there used to be 13 basic spending bills, now there's 11, some of the bills go through several committees, so it's
mm-hmm.
not so cut and dry.
Interesting, interesting. Well, it's going to be, I'm looking forward to the next 2 years. I'm guessing you are too, Ellen.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be fun covering Congress.
Indeed. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Ellen. Great talking with you today. 57 minutes past the hour on the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. New HSA comparability rules. Hey, you want to spend $160 to find out how you should handle a health savings account? I'll tell you about that right after the news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
So here's the deal. Our health care system is broken because it's a for-profit system. There are, at virtually every level, from the manufacturing of drugs to the delivery of health care in hospitals, to the delivery of health care in physicians' offices, but particularly in managing the delivery of health care, our health insurance companies, there is... The entire system is all twisted up because of this conservative notion that, well, you should just let the market determine everything and everything will work out. Just let the free market work. And so physicians end up having to hire people to do nothing more than fill out insurance company forms. Insurance companies are a giant leech on our backs, taking 20-30% of all healthcare dollars so that they can tell you, no, that's not covered by your deductible, or no, that's a pre-existing condition. And so Bush comes along and says, well, I've got another free market solution here, another free market solution to the healthcare disaster. You need to have a savings plan. A health savings account. So that if you get really sick, you can pay for it with your own money. And here, this is incredible. I got an email. It's spam. I don't know how I got on these people's list. They're down in Atlanta. From the AB Training Center, saying, attend a webcast on new HSA comparability rules. Now, this is how weird it gets. It's like, this is $160 you have to pay. Excuse me, $199 you have to pay to listen to a webcast to learn about what is the comparability rule, employer contributions, if any, then all. Excise tax under 4980G, the rationale, final regulations issued. Who are comparable participating employees? What's a controlled group basis? What are comparable contributions? If more than one HDP, different tiers of HDHP coverage. What is the process to make comparable contributions? Pay as you go, look back, reasonable and consistent period of time. What are the exceptions? The cafeteria plan exception, collectively bargained employees. Now, you know, they're not pitching this to you and me as much as to, well, they say, who should attend? Human resource managers, attorneys, controllers, CEOs, CFOs, directors, personnel managers, you know, et cetera, et cetera. CPAs, plan administrators, payroll professionals, accountants, insurance professionals. It's like, yeah, let's make the system more complicated so that we can make some more dollars off it. After all, it's just life and death. I'm telling you, the voodoo economics are destroying this country. David in Everett, Washington, you want to argue with our economics with me?
Yeah, this is Dave. This is Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to really argue with you.
Oh, rats. I put you at the front of the line because I thought you were going to disagree with me.
Well, I am going to disagree with you.
Okay, let's do it.
I mean, I'm a, just like Thomas Jefferson, I'm a laissez-faire capitalist. And
what does that mean, David?
For the edification of your audience, laissez-faire means that each individual has a right to trade their labor freely in the market.
No, laissez-faire, for the edification of the market, is French for essentially without regulation, without limits,
right?
Without rules.
The freedom to trade your labor without regulation or rules, right? Exactly.
And if there are two people, and if there are two people, if you and I, David, if you and I live next door to each other, and you wanted your car washed, and I wanted my lawn mowed, then we could sit down and we could work out a deal and just say, okay, let's do it. And you've got a true laissez-faire system. And that would be a fine thing.
That's the argument. The laissez-faire system is.
Now, what happens, David, if you and I make the deal that you're gonna mow my lawn and I'm going to wash your car, and you come over and mow my lawn, and I don't wash your car?
Yeah, I understand the delay aspect of currency and so forth.
No, I'm not talking about the delay aspect of currency. I'm talking about failure to contract. What happens if instead of washing your car, I go over there and I think, oh, it'll be cool. I'll stand on top of his car. I stand on top of it. I crush the top of your car down, the hood of your car, the top of the whatever you call the top of the car, I guess, down into the sea. I destroy your car. What are you going to do? In a laissez-faire world, you've got no recourse because there's no regulations.
I'm not saying that you don't have to have government. You have to have laws and so forth.
Well, then it's not laissez-faire.
It's absolutely laissez-faire. Laissez-faire does not, the government does not interfere with the trade. That's not interfering with the trade. That's upholding the laws. That's all.
So if our trade isn't going the way that one of us likes and government, And you want to have the recourse to the courts. You think that that is still laissez-faire capitalism?
Absolutely. You have recourse to courts. I mean, you have to have government. Laissez-faire doesn't mean that you don't have government.
Okay. So how do we define what's the value of your car or my lawn?
by the free market. I mean, free trading was here long before governments were established.
Okay, let's take this out of the well.
But let
okay,
me
you,
ask
there
you
was
this,
a point you
no,
wanted.
Let
to
me ask you this because okay. we can talk about. So let me ask you this: if a contraction, I just heard you say something about the economy. No matter what the taxes are, will continue along. They'll adjust. And there's not an economist anywhere that won't tell you taxes are a leakage to the economy, the productive economy, excuse me. What would you do as a liberal if we start into a contraction, i.e. The 29 crash?
I would probably do what Franklin Roosevelt did.
That was a disaster.
Well, we're not in the 29 crash any longer.
Yeah, but
I'm asking you,
if the perfect storm comes together and you have a liberal in office, you're going to have a 29 crash.
No, I would submit to you.
It would have happened in 1980, but the right person.
The Republican Great Depression in 1929 came about as a consequence of laissez-faire. It came about as a consequence of a lack of regulation of the stock market. It came about as a consequence of the lack of regulation of business practices, not against laissez-faire. It was an indictment of Republican and conservative economic policies. And Franklin Roosevelt put the economy back together by making the government the employer of last resort, by increasing the supply of money over time, arguably, you could say Herbert Hoover helped to some extent in 1930 by pushing through Smoot-Hawley, and my guess is that you would say Smoot-Hawley hurt the economy. That's still hotly contested by economists.
It actually caused the crash. Smoot-Hawley is what caused the crash. The economy was going along fine.
The crash occurred in 1929. Smoot-Hawley was passed at the end of 1930.
It was...
You need to go back and read your history.
The Smoot-Hawley Act was being debated in 28, and that's...
Smoot-Hawley passed Congress and became law in the fall of 1930.
But as you know...
And it was signed by Herbert Hoover.
As you know, the market always responds to what the politicians are going to do, and Smoot-Hawley caused the crash, there's no question.
No.
And Roosevelt...
I'm not buying that. What caused the crash, Joe Kennedy said it really well, and it's probably an apocryphal story. Gloria Swanson told it to me. She used to be on the board of one of our organizations. She said Joe Kennedy told her that, and I've heard the same story of other financiers, that when the shoeshine boy started giving him stock tip advice, that's when he knew it was time to get out of the market. What brought down the market in 1929 was the fact that you could buy stock on a 10% margin.
Roosevelt's policies, when implemented, first of all, he
built the strongest middle class in the history of the United States.
He never got out of the Depression. World War II is the only thing that brought him out of the Depression.
World War II did not get us out of the Depression. World War II slowed down the pace with which we were getting out of the Depression because it reduced our productive capacity.
The entire 30s. Would you want to live in the 30s? My dad grew up in the 30s.
Yeah, my grandparents were here in the 1930s. No, I would not wish the Great Depression on anybody, and that's why I'm opposed to laissez-faire economics, because the Republican Great Depression is something I don't want to see repeated again. And what I've seen since Reagan came into office is a repeat of the same practices that we saw under Harding and Coolidge and Hoover that led to the Republican Great Depression. Don't you get it that when you say World War II took us out of the Great Depression? World War II, building bombers and tanks, did nothing to build the infrastructure of the United States. Yes, certainly there was a short-term stimulus, but I would submit to you that the recessions of the late 40s and early 50s were the result of the fact that we were spending all of our treasure, so much of our treasure and our sweat, on things that ended up blowing up over Dresden rather than building roads and highways and infrastructure. World War II did not bring us out of the Great Depression. It was a distraction from the process of bringing us out of the Great Depression.
It was a distraction. It was a distraction to put everybody back to work. And when people came back to work, they were happy. Look at you can run high tax rates when the economy is moving along. The problem occurs, and what's going to occur in the future, because we're in a position where if we get a contraction going and the wrong person is in office, it's going to cause a depression. A depression will.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Where we're disagreeing is who the wrong person is. David, we got to wrap it up at that.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. I would also agree with Mud Mike over in the chat room. He says, Tom, all those idiots think that the government burns the money it collects in taxes. I'm sorry, it spends that money, so taxes are not a net drain on the economy. And I would say yes, except for war. Because with war, when you spend tax dollars on war, you are collecting tax dollars, and instead of educating people, which is an investment that produces a return on investment, you know, you spend $1 million educating young people, and you're going to get back 10, 20, 30, 50 million dollars in tax revenues from future productive wage earners, or building highways or railroads or airports that produce, you know, the infrastructure that produces, that facilitates commerce. Instead, if your tax dollars are building domestic infrastructure, then tax dollars will stimulate the economy, because those are solid investments. Building water systems, building power systems, building septic systems. But if those tax dollars are used to build bombs or missiles, then one of two things is going to happen. Either those bombs or missiles are never used, in which case those tax dollars are gone. They might as well have been burned, number one. Or they are used, they're dropped on somebody, like 655,000 Iraqis, who innocent civilians who died in this war. And those dollars still vanish. All you have to show for it is a bunch of dead people. So the whole Republican argument, and I know the Republicans have been making it since the 1950s, that what got us out of the Great Depression was World War II, is wrong. It's just, it's demonstrably wrong. It is a fallacy. And you can, I mean, just go back and look at the timeline of history. We were coming out of the Great Depression by 1936. The official end of the Great Depression, by and large, according to most economists, is somewhere between 1937 and 1939. Had nothing to do with the war. The war slowed down our recovery. Roosevelt's policies really took hold in the 1950s and 1960s. They were still in place. In the 1970s, when we were no longer at war, although I'd say that, they got slowed down again by another war, the war in Vietnam in the late 60s and early 70s, which led to some of the recessions in the 1980s. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Yeah, that last caller reminds me of all those FDR haters, con revisionists, just like Newt Gingrich now trying to say that all the founders are Christians.
Yeah, and Thomas Jefferson was not an advocate. He was an advocate of laissez-faire economics. He actually thought Desuet de Tracy was the most brilliant economist. He translated his writings from the French into the English in secret while he was president of the United States. You should read his letters with Lafayette, because Lafayette was the intermediary, the Marquis de Lafayette in France.
Right.
He had to do it in secret, because if Napoleon ran France at that time, if Napoleon had found out that he was doing it, Napoleon would have declared war against the United States for Jefferson being a proponent of sedition. Desuet de Tracy, who Jefferson translated and who was his hero, is the founder of the French Liberal School of Economics.
So no,
now,
I know.
Now, it means the European liberal, so it's a little closer to laissez-faire than what we have now, but nonetheless. In any case, Tom, that's not what you call it.
Yeah, well, even Nixon said, after we came out of the Republican Great Depression, he said, we are all Keynesians now. It's proven correct, and that's what it was all about, Keynesian economics. And
yeah.
I like to quote end here with John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a advisor to FDR and also a Keynesian, and this is off the top of my head, but he said the conservatives, you probably have it in front of you, the conservatives are not all they're about. Their philosophy is to have a moral justification for selfishness, basically, and they search like Ayn Rand to look for all these moral underpinnings for basically greed and selfishness.
Yeah, well said, Tom. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Sandy in Alameda, California. Alameda, I've been there. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Sandy.
Star Trek fans will know it's where they keep the nuclear
in
Star Trek 4.
Indeed. Okay.
So,
what's up?
So I'm holding a concrete example in my hand of what you were just talking about the Democrats bringing us out of the Great Depression. My grandfather was a young man who was ready to just starve to death in South Carolina as the Depression came on.
Don't call it the Depression, Sandy. Call it the Republican Great Depression, because that's what it was.
Great Depression, yeah. And he joined the Civilian Conservation Corps, like the Works Projects Administration.
Right.
It was one of those great programs that Roosevelt put in place to put people back to work.
Right.
And this guy earlier had said that it was the war who did it. Well, he didn't, you know, build bombers, like you said, to blow up over Dresden. He built dams and trails and roads that were still there when we were kids.
And schools.
We used to go. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we used to go to these buildings and see these places. And I have this bowl that he hand-carved while he was in the barracks there at one of the camps.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of young men there, and he learned the trade while he was there of electricity and being an electrician. And he went on to work in Oak Ridge and helped wire that secret city to build the atomic bomb, left there, went to work for the Tennessee Valley Authority, brought electricity to the entire Tennessee Valley as a lineman. Went down to Florida after hurricanes to rewire that. He learned a hard skill that was useful. His work didn't end up blowing up over Dresden.
There you go.
Maybe over Japan.
Yeah, leave that out. Well said, Sandy. Well said. And an excellent point that you make, and I appreciate you making it. Thank you very much for the call. Very well said. And by the way, when he went to work, when your grandfather went to work for the Tennessee Valley Authority, that was another example where government had to step in because the laissez-faire marketplace said, no, we're not going to give money to rural areas, or electricity, rather.
The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall. The cavalry was quiet, except for the drilling in the wall. The curtain had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway, looking like the Jack of Hearts.
And welcome back to Listener Supported Radio. It's the Tom Harmon Radio Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting the radio station you're hearing us on, by buying things from their sponsors and letting them know that you're listening. And our national sponsors as well, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, all fair trade, all organic, and some extraordinary coffee like Ethiopian coffee. That's literally the country where coffee began. You've never tasted anything like this in your life. SacredGroundsCoffee.com or 1-800-425-2532. Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now, all things Macintosh, all things computer for that matter. 1-800-511-MAX, smalldog.com, their website, 1-800-511-MACS. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, 1-888-ECO-WINE, the Organic Wine Company. Our quote for the day, nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's true character, give him power. That from Abraham Lincoln. And we're going to go back to your phone calls in just a second, but first let's just check in with how things are going in the ongoing U.S. occupation, not war, occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. And there are lights in the balance.
Dateline Baghdad, a roadside bomb killed one person and wounded three others in Al-Shahora area. In Dalia province, two U.S. soldiers were killed on Wednesday when their vehicle was hit by a roadside bomb. In Baghdad, a car bomb killed one person and wounded four in the northern Al-Akira district. In Dalia province, a U.S. soldier was killed by small arms fire. In Baghdad, gunmen attacked the convoy of the governor of Mosul, Duryad Kasmali. I'd killed one of his guards and wounded four others in Mosul. Near Dusufia, U.S. forces killed nine insurgents and detained nine others during a raid. In Baghdad, a U.S. soldier was shot dead. In Mosul, three insurgents were killed and one wounded on Monday when a roadside bomb they were trying to plant exploded prematurely. In Baghdad, gunmen opened fire on a bakery in eastern Baghdad, killing nine people and wounding two. In Baghdad, a car bomb near a court killed two people and wounded five in northeast Palestine Street in Baghdad, according to the Interior Ministry. Also in Baghdad, a bicycle rigged with explosives near a gas station killed a man and wounded another, and a roadside bomb targeting police commandos killed one and wounded another near the National Stadium of Al-Shahab in eastern Baghdad, again, according to the Interior Ministry. These all from Reuters, effective as of 8 o'clock this morning. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Jake in Eureka, California, KGOE. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? I'd like to discuss the issue of racism in the Republican Party, specifically their choice of Trent Lott, of all people, the segregationist, the Strom Thurmond supporter, as minority whip. You know, the next time, Tom, Trent Lott goes on with Glenn Beck, I think Trent Lott should be asked to prove to all of us that he, in fact, does not burn crosses and does not lynch black people, considering the fact that he said Strom Thurmond should have been president, and then they wouldn't have had all those problems over all these years, like civil rights and voting rights. You know, the Republican Party is clearly racist, and it's time that we all just point out that when you see a Republican politician on TV and that little R next to their name doesn't stand for Republican, that R stands for racist, Tom.
Yeah, and in fact, in 72, Nixon pretty much laid this out. I mean, it was the Southern strategy. I believe it was Bill Moyers on this program who told the story. And Jake, thanks for bringing this up, by the way. Bill Moyers, I may be wrong in my recollection, but I'm pretty sure it was one of the times that he was on this program, and he was telling the story of being in the White House with Lyndon Johnson when the Democrats came in, when the Speaker of the House came in. I'm not recalling who it was at the time. And in 1967 with the Voting Rights Act, or the Civil Rights Act, and said to Lyndon Johnson, Mr. Johnson, or one of his advisors, said to him, President Johnson, if you sign this law, if you sign this piece of legislation, the Democratic Party will lose the South for a generation. And Lyndon Johnson said, if that's the cost of doing what's right, I'll do it. Now, you know, Johnson was a sleazy politician in a lot of ways, and he did a lousy job with the Vietnam War. But he was a stand-up guy when it came to the war on poverty and when it came to issues of race in the United States, and transformed this country in many positive ways. He cut poverty in half in the United States in 4 years. He put into place programs that allowed people like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, who were both beneficiaries of affirmative action, to get to where they are. And so what happened to those Southern racists? Well, Richard Nixon came along after Lyndon Johnson left office. LBJ, his own party, wouldn't renominate him for re-election because of the Vietnam War. So Hubert Humphrey had to run. Lyndon Nixon beat him. Nixon comes in and he says, you know, there's a bunch of racists down south, and they don't have a party anymore. Republicans will fill that void. And sure enough, they did. And sure enough, they have. John in Oakland, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, John, what's up?
Tom, you know, I think we've got to understand that the military-industrial complex has got its tentacles into the leadership of the Democratic Party as much as the Republicans. And I think we have to put in context the tough talk foreign policy statements of people like Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, in that context, because I think if you look at the neocon warmongers in the Bush administration, a lot of them had their roots in the Democratic Party, the leadership of the Democratic Party, which was dominated by the Scoop Jackson senator from Boeing military industrial complex wing. And so I think, in a way, we're in trouble because the Democrats have just as much been a party of war, warmongering, hot and cold war mongering and militarism as the Republicans. And I think if you look at the use of human rights, it's just a simple switch of a 51-49% use of human rights versus scaremongering and threatmongering and boogeymanging from, you know, demonizing other countries. And it is simply reversed in the Republicans as 51-49. And I think in both cases, the use of human rights has been used as a phony pretext throughout the Cold War to justify some of the most horrendous wars from Vietnam to Korea to everything else. And I think if we don't understand that countries like China, which I don't think is communist anymore, I think it was a deformed version of it before now, I think it's capitalist, that this is the ultimate target of the neocons. People like Wolfowitz and Pearl and others were in the Democratic Party and pushing this Cold War attitude. And if we're going to add a Cold War pretext for war to the phony war on terrorism, and I think that's the policy of the Democrats, we're going to be even more dangerously moving towards war. And I think the Chinese government, you know, whatever abuses it has, and I don't trust all of the propaganda, has justified having unions in China against the wish.
They don't have unions, John. They have union. There is one union, and it is the official union, and it is controlled by the state and by the Communist Party.
Well, look at this, though. This was even in the New York Times front page, that they said that Walmart and the rest of the U.S. corporations had to allow that
union in. And what that union does is just another way for the Communist Party to suck a little money out of the giant money machine that is multinational corporations doing business in China.
You may be right.
I am right about it. But
human rights or the degree of human rights abuses over there has nothing to do with the interest of the Nancy Pelosi's, the Bidens, and the Hillary Clintons.
How do you know that, John?
First of all,
let me say I don't disagree with you that the Democratic Party has a long history going back certainly to the 1950s of being in bed with the military-industrial complex, as has the Republicans. The Republican Party, I would submit, has abused that much more, or has been much more addicted to that than has the Democratic Party. But they're both guilty of that sin. And
well,
that's
I think
it's so important that people of goodwill take over the Democratic Party, infiltrate it from the ground up, and become the Democratic Party. Because if we allow it to be the party of Republican light, we're screwed. Well, and here's an opportunity. I mean, this is the beginning, not the end. We shouldn't be sitting around celebrating. We should be saying this is the starting point.
Well, I'm just saying, though, that I think if they're going to be successful, the leadership of the Democratic Party, the Clintons, the Bidens, and the Pelosi's, and dragging us into not only a phony war on terrorism, but a resuscitation of a new Cold War against China, in the guise of a progressive liberalism, this is even more dangerous, because
this kind of humanitarian cover
is going to be even more
seductive. I'm not disagreeing with you. Although, as I said, we need to be pointing out that this, you know, the fear is not necessary, that's not the game. You know, fear is not where we need to go. We need to go back to...
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And I would submit to you that, to a large extent, John is absolutely right, that the weight of this combination of the military and the industrial... Eisenhower, in that speech, he pointed out before he got to that point in the speech that prior to World War II, we had never had a permanent war machine in the United States. We had. I mean, we had Ford and Chrysler and General Motors building tanks on car assembly lines in the 1940s. And now we do. What do we do with it? 45 minutes past the hour.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this song. I could kill a couple minutes just talking to lieutenants about Saddam Hussein. I could grasp what they were saying and the dangerous game we're playing. If I only had a brain.
Yes. And wouldn't the world be finer? Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The pill that will help you escape the Matrix, our program. And Dwight D. Eisenhower, Republican President of the United States in 1960, as he's leaving office, 1961, actually. It was in January 1961. He said,
as we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government, must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage.
We cannot mortgage the assets of our grandchildren without also risking their political and spiritual heritage. That's exactly what's been going on since Ronald Reagan. Exactly.
We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
And that's, again, what the Republicans are bringing us. I'm telling you, Dwight Eisenhower is rolling over in his grave. He continued in that speech.
During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
Whoa, that liberal Dwight Eisenhower. And In many ways, he was. He ended his speech, his 1961 speech, as he was leaving office, with a prayer for the future of America.
May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration. We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth, and that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
The binding, this from the man who led the U.S. forces into Europe to fight back the Nazis. This from the man who led the military machine that killed hundreds of thousands, arguably millions of people, in the defense of democracy against a Nazi machine, a death cult that had swept across Europe. This from a man who understood the horror of war, unlike the chicken hawks in the current administration, who all managed somehow to have other priorities or get out of Vietnam. And their understanding of war is you know, bad movies and don't get me started. Bill in Chicago. Hey, Bill. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Listen, to get back to your guy about the your caller about the Great Depression.
Right. It was and again, it was Dwight Eisenhower who as president from 1952 to 1960 maintained a 90% top marginal tax rate and maintained strong tariffs and built a middle class.
You know, as your program progressed, I was listening and thinking of more things. But first, the first thing I wanted to point out is, in my reading of history before I went to college, getting my degree, GI Bill degree in college and history, I mean, I've always loved history. The fact of the matter is, I've never found any group of people that ever agreed on what caused the Depression. To this day, they still argue about what caused the Depression.
Yep.
I do know that farmers were in a Depression in 1926.
Yeah.
So, anyway, but...
Well, farmers were in a Depression in 1887, too. I mean, when the railroads started colluding with the big grain wholesalers, and that's why the farmers got together and formed the Grange as a farmers' union to fight back.
Right.
I mean, that battle was going on. That was a seesaw that went back and forth from the mid-1880s right through the Great Depression.
Right. But I was just pointing out about the farmers is it wasn't the stock market crash that began the Depression. You know, it was...
Interesting. I should have said the Republican Great Depression. Excuse me, Bill.
But the other thing is he fails to point out the fact that historically, after every war, there was a depression, except the Second World War. That was because of the New Deal. Basically, the programs of the New Deal and the spending programs of the New Deal helped stop the a depression, and of course, the fact that the rest of the world had been bombed in the rubble, and we loaned them money and then sold them the stuff, you know, the...
That's a good point. There was an economic panic in the 1780s. There was the panic of the 1870s after the Civil War.
After the First World War, there was a small depression for about a year and a half after the First World War.
Yeah, because what war does is it wrings cash, resources, assets out of an economy and doesn't return them to the economy in a productive way.
Right, and all of a sudden that relocation happens. The people come back from the war. The production for war stops. You know.
Right, and it takes a while for production to pick back up, and those people need resources when they come back. That's a great point, Bill. Thank you for sharing that.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening. Tomorrow, brunch with Senator Bernie. Bernie Sanders taking your calls as he has every Friday here at noon Eastern time for the last 3 years. And also, I'll be challenging conservative David Denholm. He says that government employees are overpaid. They should make the same as greeters at Walmart. And don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.